that. So getting back to our main question, which was, when did the story of Ruth take place? Are we able in some way to pinpoint exactly when this entire story happened? And for that, we're going to focus on the beginning and the end of the Megillah, which, as we're going to see, are quite central to answering this question. And we're going to have to go in, you know, a bit of a deeper dive into those sections than we did originally. But more so, I'd like us to think about all of the details in the Megillah that we might be able to use to help identify this. And we'll take a look not only at just what we think, but also at what people have suggested before, ranging from, again, Chazal to, you know, late non-Jewish sources. We will hopefully cover all of the different approaches, or at least most of the different approaches that I was able to find, and to try to see what motivates people to say things like this. And if that's the case, hopefully to be able to get a deeper understanding and a better understanding of what's happening in this Megillah. But this is just one of the many, many questions that we can ask. Some of the other questions we can ask were in the voluntary assignment last week. You know, and hopefully being able to go through the entire Megillah allows for us to answer these questions in more detail and better than we would by just, again, going with one approach or one parallel, but to really think and analyze the Psukim based on how we may have brought up some interpretations and to see how far that goes. So the first section here I entitled General Considerations. General considerations, I think these are basically these three bullet points that I have here. One, two, and three. One is the first pasuk of Sefer of the book. The second one is a chronology of Sefer Shoftim, which, as we're going to see, obviously it's very closely tied in with. And finally, we have the last section of the Sefer, going down to the final psukim. And those will help us sort of see the what I would think are the important, those are the crucial passages in determining when this actually takes place. So let's see. And at this point, again, if people could unmute themselves, I would be appreciative of that, and just to be able to chime in whenever you so please. So, Vahi bimei shefot hashoftim. It was in the days of the judging of the judges, and that's how we'll translate it for now. You can translate it slightly differently when the cheftains ruled in this translation. Vayehi ra'av ba'aretz, and there was a famine in the land. Vayelech ish mibeit lechem Yehuda, a man went. Or a man from Beit Lechem Yehuda went. It's either that he left from Beit Lechem Yehuda or that a man from Beit Lechem Yehuda went, but that doesn't really matter. Lagur b'stei Moav, to bigur, again, whatever that means, dwell in the fields of Moav, hu v'ishto shnei banav, him and his wife and his two sons. What details do you see in this pasuk that can help us identify when the story takes place? How many different details do we have that can help us figure out when this is happening?
Well, judges, and then if a famine, right?
Okay, so we've got one is something to do with judges, yes. Two is a famine, yes. Anything else? Is there any other detail that someone can spot in this pasuk that would tell us more information about a time in which this Megillah is taking place?
Moab has to have had a land, yes.
Moab has to have had a land, although, yeah, technically speaking, I mean, we don't really know of times when it doesn't have a land.
Right.
Anybody? So one detail of it that we can look at is that someone is able to go from Israel into Moab and to move there with their family. Now, based on how we look at the rest of the Megillah, those details may be very, very important. So if, for example, we see a reception or a general feel from other details of the Megillah that Moab is on bad terms with the Jewish people, that would be something to pick up on. If Moab is on good terms with the Jewish people, that would be something to pick up on. What they do there, how successful they are there, how integrated they're able to become there, those types of things can also give us an idea of the relationship between the Jewish nation and Moab at that time. So that, I think, is also an important detail. We will see from a midrashic perspective, places have a whole lot of importance as well. The Midrash, in a number of places, picks up on places that people will live in and will draw all sorts of parallels like that. But I think those three are the three big ones that we see in this pasuk. Number one, it's sometime during the reign of the judges. Number two, it's at a time when there's a famine. Number three, it's at a time where people seem to be able to travel freely from Beit Lehem to Moab. Granted that that may be something that was looked upon negatively at the time. Number two is because we've said that this is happening sometime in when the Shoftim ruled, I figured I would give a basic chronology of Sefer Shoftim. Now, there are so many different opinions here. It's really chaval that I didn't see any good resources online that clearly laid it out according to each of the sort of traditional Mefarshim. I didn't see one chart according to Rashi and one chart according to Abarbanel, one chart according to whomever else, Radak, and one chart according to modern scholars and one chart. So, although, of course, among modern scholars, you probably have another 12 charts, not one. But nevertheless, I thought I would, you know, pull from a couple of traditional sources, but really this is a huge mishmash. It's just meant to give a general idea based on the psukim that talk about the reigns of the different judges. And we're going to make reference back to some of these later. We don't get absolutely everybody here, but we get sort of the general idea. I have four columns. So one is the leader at that time. Another one is their reign, how long we are told that they were shofate for or similar. Time from end was just something that I added in for people to get an idea of at the end of that individual's reign, how much time is there until Shimshon's reign, really, which would be towards the end of the Shoftim, but you can really add on a lot more, and it's really just subjective. But the main goal is to get an idea of approximately where we are in terms of years through Shoftim, and then some notes, what this calculation may include, how it may overlap. Just to note, according to these same calculations, David is anointed king of Israel approximately 50 years after the end of the book of Shoftim, which would mean approximately 50 years after Shimshon is done ruling. Again, you can have all sorts of different calculations. There may be even people that say Shimshon was not one of the last judges. I'm aware, but again, we're working with this for now. And the last, and we'll make reference back to this repeatedly when we try to place this in different places within Sefer Shoftim. And finally, we have the end of the Sefer of Megillat Rus. And we really pick up from Vadikrana Shemo Oved. His name was called Oved. Hu Avi Yishai Avi David. He was the father of Yishai, the father of David. We've got a whole list, a whole chronological list from Peretz, who, as you can see in the note above, lived approximately 600 years before David HaMelech, all the way down to David HaMelech. Now, what are some of the considerations that we have to keep in mind when reading this list? I think these were mainly mentioned when we went through the psukim. Anybody who's unmuted? What do we need to keep in mind when reading this list in terms of figuring out the chronology of this book and really this whole list here?
Don't know the ages. We don't know the ages when they begot. So it's hard to tell exactly how long the timeline is.
Very good. I think that's actually better than most people would put it. I think most people would naturally look, we don't know how long they lived. The answer is we don't really care how long they lived. We care at what age they had children, because that's what we're recording here. We're recording generations. So if I live for 200 years, but you know, I have a child when I'm 20, well, then that's already the next step of the genealogy that's listed here. So we don't know when any of these people would have had their children, and then when we'd be able to identify when the book is happening. What are two easy ways, based on this genealogy, that we could date Megillat Rus? This is not a trick question. Well, one way we could look at counting from the top, we could say, okay, here's Peretz, based on what we know, Peretz, Chetzron, et cetera, Ram, Aminadav, Nachshon, Salma, Salmon, or even to jump to the middle of the list, really, and say, well, we know Nachshon ben Aminadav lived here. He was a contemporary of Moshe and Aaron. He may have been slightly younger than them. We know that Aaron marries Elisheva bat Aminadav achot Nachshon, so he's approximately contemporary with them. And so then let's count down from there. And we could say that, again, with some terms of uncertainty, because we don't know exactly when people had their children. On the other hand, we can count it from the other side. We can say, well, we know that David HaMelech lived at such and such a time. Let's count back from him. Again, whatever we can approximate as to when people would have had their children. Do we have any evidence of different points in time when people would have had their children? Both from internally within Megillat Ruth and elsewhere.
Not so interactive today.
I can hear the crickets.
I don't know.
So I'll ask you a question. Can you think of when any single one of these people might have had a child in their life? Might they have had it at a young age, at an advanced age? What indication might you have?
The father of David. Jesse had it when he was older. Because David was his youngest son.
Okay, so that's one. If David is the youngest son of Yishai, so he probably had him when he was at a later age than when he had his first or earlier children. Of course, we know he had a significant number of children. So that may be an indication that, yes, that was may have been a longer gap. That's a really good one. Anybody else in the list that we can think of?
Boaz, that was Ruth's son. Like, I mean, Obed, that was Ruth's son, and she was must have been older when she had a child,
because right?
It was like 10 years after her husband passed away, was it?
At the very least. Well, it could have been that he passed away at the end of the 10 years that they dwelled there, but who are we looking at the child relative to, the mother or the father here? To Boaz. Was Boaz advanced in age by the time that he had Obed? Yes. Quite likely. Again, we talked about some of the different pieces of evidence we may have in within Megillat Ruth to look at that. What else? Simply looking at this list, the big question that we have to ask is this in fact a complete list? Are there people skipped? Where are the people skipped? And how important is that? If I were to ask you, which ones do you think are least likely to be skips? Which ones would you tell me? Which ones are most likely to be sets of fathers and sons or grandfathers? You know, fathers and sons. You can vote. There's no wrong answers here.
Well, parents is important.
Okay, why is parents important?
Because it's where it starts, Yehuda and Tamar.
Right, so Yehuda and Tamar. Notice we don't go a generation up to Yehuda and Tamar. We start with parents. We discussed why that was within the Megillah itself. So you would say parents having Chetzron is something that you think is likely to be a father and son?
Yeah.
Okay, any reason for that?
Because I believe they wouldn't lie.
Okay, so you would say to say Holid, and if they were not their biological son, but if rather they were a grandson or a great-grandson, the Torah would not write that.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, I mean, that's an interesting approach. We do see in Chazal already the notion of B'nei Vanim Harayim Kevanim, which may be applied in all sorts of different ways, certainly in Midrashic ways, you know, to say whether or not Chetzron, you know, Holid means that he literally had him, you can definitely find Mefarshim that will take it that way. And they will say this entire list, I mean, if we said there's approximately 600 years, and again, I'm just giving rough estimates here, I'm not trying to do exact counts, from Peretz to David. So, I mean, you're looking at how many generations that are covering those 600 years. Peretz, Chetzron, Ram, Aminadav, Nachshon, Salma, Boaz, Oved, Yishai, David. Okay, so we've got our essentially 10 generations covering 600 years. That's a pretty advanced age on average that we're going to have people having children. Now, realizing that, you know, Peretz is living, I would say, around 600 years before David is living. You could say maybe, you know, when did David ascend to the throne? When was he born? You might be able to cut down that number a little bit. But you're looking at, on average, something like 50, 60, 70 that people are having these children. Now, it's true, you may have certain people that are having them much later than others. So we know that generally earlier on in history, people would have children at a more advanced age. Not necessarily do we have evidence of specific individuals, but as we saw, at least two we suspect would have been having children at a more advanced age, one of those being Boaz and one of those being Yishai. So you can definitely make the chronology work like that. As we mentioned during the shiur, there is one thing, one particular area that even more traditional commentaries are willing to admit the possibility of skipping. Where is that? Does someone identify that piece in the last psukim here?
So what is your question?
So the question is, even among those who would normally say so-and-so holid so-and-so means that you can't have a skip in generations. We'll assume that holid means to literally be father, have a father and son relationship between them. Where would even those commentaries concede that there's possibility of a gap in this genealogy? Where might there be a gap, even if you normally wouldn't admit to a gap? And this will work only in the Hebrew, not in the English. I will note, the translation does not work well for this question. Anybody who's still muted want to unmute themselves and help us out here? Okay, we ready for a spoiler? I'm going to highlight it on my screen. Yes, Elaine?
I was about to say that.
Okay, so who does Nachshon give birth to? Someone named?
Salma.
And who's the next person to be listed is not Salma again, like we see with all of the other people, but someone named Salmon. Is it possible that Salma and Salmon are two different people, perhaps a grandfather and grandson, or that there are other generations inserted there? Even those who would otherwise not be comfortable saying that would be comfortable saying that here. Now, you can make the argument that there were two Chetzrons and one was the grandfather of the other one. And I don't want to get too much into that now, but there definitely are ways to read this genealogy as incomplete, even, you know, for the most traditional Mefarshim. Nevertheless, let's assume that it is, and that we have Boaz giving birth at a fairly advanced age, or at the very least becoming a father to Oved at a very advanced age, Yishai potentially having David at a very advanced age. So what type of timeline does that give us, either if we're counting from Peretz or if we're counting back from David? Now, if we assume that certain genealogy, that it's approximately equal all the way through, meaning that parents are always, if we took the average, well, each parent would have their child at approximately, let's say, 60. Well, then we would say, well, if we move up from David, 60 years back would bring us to Yishai. 60 years back would bring us to Oved. So that would be about 120 years back from when David becomes king. So where is that going to put us? We're going to have to look back at our Shoftim chart in a minute. If we look the other way, or if we say that may have been longer, maybe Oved and Yishai both gave birth at very late ages, then that might give us even more time. That might give us closer even to 200 years. Again, depending on how much we're willing to say, how old was David when he becomes king, et cetera, et cetera. But from when David is born, you can't be going back more than 200 years. I mean, that's already pretty crazy. So that's basically the area that we're in. It's going to throw us somewhere into the middle of Sefer Shoftim, and we'll look at that. So what that gives us, you can go the other way as well. You can look at Nachshon ben Aminadav and say, hey, Boaz is only two generations after Nachshon ben Aminadav. Nachshon ben Aminadav is someone who, you know, was in the Dor HaMidbar. So, you know, you're maybe going two generations from there. That could be ostensibly, again, if you're going with 60s, that could be one calculation. If you're going with 70s, that could be another calculation. If you're going with 80s, that could be another calculation. But you're also getting not too far into Sefer Shoftim, because you've got to finish the wilderness. You've got to finish the Midbar. Then you've got to finish all of Sefer Yehoshua. And when Yehoshua dies and when the Shoftim start, and how far already are you going to get into Sefer Shoftim? Those are some of the considerations that people have from this section. As we said, the first section gives us the idea that it's in the Shvot HaShoftim. It's during a famine, and there's passage from Beit Lechem Yehuda to go to Moab. Okay, just before we move on to the suggestions that have been made, actually, no, let's move on right to them. It's already getting late here. I'm stalling everything as I should not be. So the first question is, in dealing with this, and here we are lucky to see Midrashim that directly address this question and then try to fill in this gap, is it talks about Vahi Bimei Shefot HaShoftim. If you were authoring the Sefer and you wanted to give a time frame of when this happened, what would you write?
I would write which Shofet it was.
Right, so I might, as you seemingly would, if it was, let's say, during the time of Otniel ben Kenaz, or if it was during the time of Shimshon, or if it was during the time of whoever, I would write Vahi Bimei Shimshon. That doesn't sound like a bad idea. Why write Vahi Bimei Shefot HaShoftim? And that question, in order to answer that question, we're going to have to start thinking about the answer to our other question as to when did this take place. So what might be something that the Pasuk is trying to convey to us with the words Shefot HaShoftim, as opposed to writing during the reign of which Shofet this took place in? Any suggestions?
If it was in a particular age of a certain Shofet, then you might want to contextualize it, but the story of Ruth shouldn't be contextualized.
Okay, so you would say to avoid giving it context?
Yeah.
That's not something we would usually see. You could say that we want to keep it vague. I guess that's, you know, basically the same idea, which is to say we don't want anybody to know when this is happening, because the story is better if we don't know when in the time of the Shoftim is happening for some reason. I think that's fair. Certainly that can imply it, and that would definitely be one approach. Any other suggestions? Why would the verse specifically say Shefot HaShoftim as opposed to identifying a particular Shofet if in fact it historically did happen during the time of a particular Shofet?
Maybe it happened at the time of more than a bunch of Shoftim. So
very good. I think that that's a possible interpretation, is that maybe it wasn't during just one Shofet. Maybe it was during multiple Shoftim. And when I say multiple Shoftim, I don't mean multiple Shoftim at once. I mean, maybe it was spanned a number of different Shoftim who were leading Israel. So this story, as we said, again, when we were going through the actual Megillah, we talked a number of times as to how long this might have taken. From when Elimelech leaves till when, you know, everything is settled between Boaz and Ruth, let's leave aside the genealogy at the end for a moment, because we're assuming that's not really part of the story of the Megillah for now. That could be a very long time. Elimelech and Naomi could leave with two babies, and Ruth, you know, who could be married to them after who knows how many years of dwelling in Moab, again, that they dwelled there for 10 years, and then, you know, they die eventually sometime after that. You could be dealing with the span of 30, 40, maybe even 50 years. It's unclear exactly when, but you can definitely fetch that into the Pshat, and I think that would be a fair interpretation of Shefot HaShoftim. We'll see how Chazal actually used that approach in some way, and how they understand this to for sure be referring to multiple Shoftim. Yes.
I don't recall, but I could be wrong. Is she not referred to sometime in Ruth as a Na'ara? As a young lady?
Yes.
So therefore, she's referred to as a young lady. Likely she was a young lady.
Yes, that's possible, but...
And she could be 50 and having babies. I mean, she could be 50 and having babies in Tanakh land, but in real life, you know, womanhood land, she probably wouldn't.
But she could be 30, and this story could have begun, Elimelech rising to prominence. Could have been something that before even he goes to Moab. We're sort of picking up at that point. But if it's saying Vahi Bimei Shefot HaShoftim, you can certainly be dealing with a span of 30 years. We don't even know if Ruth was born at that time.
Okay.
Right? When is it happening that Vayisulahem Nashim Moaviot? Again, were Machlon and Chelion born and traveling as babies to begin with? Then, after 20 years of living in Moab, they marry, and then Vayeshvu Sham Ke'eser Shanim, which, as we said, doesn't need to necessarily refer to the entire length of time they were there, period, but it could refer to after they married. It could be a bit longer. Again, you can talk about that, but yes. The other question is, need it be a period of 30 years in order to span more than one shoftim? Well, it depends which shoftim you're talking about. If you jump up to the table, you have some shoftim that ruled for very short periods of time, and we have others that ruled for much longer periods of time. So yes, I mean, that's something that you can answer. And as we're going to see, let's take a look at the way Chazal explained it. So Chazal gives this two meanings. And there are other ways that we can interpret this phrase, and I'm going to get to them in shortly. But Yibim Eshifot HaShoftim says, source number four, Oy Lador Sheshaftu Es Shoftehem. Woe is to the generation that judged its judges. So first of all, they say this is not about providing a time. This is about providing a context, really. And it's not just the context of the book of Shoftim, but specifically bad Shoftim. Bad people and bad shoftim. Oy lador sheshaftu es shoftehem, v'oy lador sheshoftav tzrichem lihishafet, sh'ne'amar v'gamal shoftehem lo shameyu. People weren't listening to their leaders. And they say this is not really talking about a time, but at the end of the day, asks the Medrash, umi hayu, who were these shoftim? So right away, Rav Amar, Barak u'devora hayu. It wasn't just one person, it was two people. Barak u'devora now. Devora we generally refer to as being Hishofetet as Yisrael Ve'Esahi, and that she was the judge of that time. She comes along with all sorts of other people. We can find, if you look through Sefer Shoftim, at least three other people that are identified as having ruled the Jewish people or been in some position of prominence at the time, that the time is referred to after them. Anybody remember who they are offhand? Or you can check the list above. If you have the source sheet open in front of you. So we have another heroine of the story, who is Yael, Eshet Chever HaKeni, and the Navi tells us, Bimei Shamgar Ben Anat Bimei Yael. So it's noted as being not only in the days of Yael at that time, but also the days of Shamgar. And Barak, of course, is mentioned prominently in that story as well. So the first opinion, which is Rav, note that many versions have this as Rabba Bar Yitzchak, not Rav. He says, Barak U'Devorah Hayu, that's who these two Shoftim were. Shifot HaShoftim is actually in plural. And therefore, it did happen at the time there were two shoftim during Barak's time and Devorah's time. Rav Shua ben Levi Omer, no, it was Shamgar ve'Ehud. As we noted above, Shamgar, it's unclear exactly when he ruled. We know that he ruled sometime between Ehud and Devorah, but pretty much overlapped with them. And what exactly was his role? It's not 100% clear, but he would have been at the end of the rule of Ehud and towards the beginning of the rule of Devorah. So Rabbi Shua ben Levi says it was at the end of Ehud's reign. Rav Huna Amar, Devorah Uvarak V'Yael Hayu. Rav Huna says something very strange. He essentially repeats the first opinion, just he adds in Yael. Why? Shifot Chad, Shoftim Train, HaShoftim Tlasa. Based on the grammar of the Pasuk in a very midrashic way, he says it has to be three. If it would just say Vahi Bimei, I don't know, Shoftim, that would be one. Shifot HaShoftim would be two. Shifot Shoftim would be two. And Shifot HaShoftim would have to be three. Therefore, he adds in Yael. Now, note that he doesn't disagree then with Rav, or again, whoever that first opinion is. But those are some of the, that's the way the Medrash takes this, really to fill in this detail based on a very midrashic source of grammar issues that we have in the Pasuk. But also giving us a reason as to how we would interpret this. Why does it say Shifot HaShoftim as opposed to Vayhi Bimei Barak U'Devorah? Because we need to emphasize that Oy Lador Sheshaftu Es Shoftehem, Oy Lador Sheshoftav Tzrichen Lihishafet. I should note, by the way, that Dr. Yael Ziegler, who of course literally wrote the book on Ruth, and we quote her below, is very strongly of the opinion this is not intended to be chronological. I'm not sure that I agree with that, but certainly you can make the argument for that. And she tries to lay this out more in terms of context of understanding Ruth than actually when it might have taken place in terms of, and she has actually two chapters in her book dedicated to Rus versus Shoftim. So she's definitely the expert on that. Other ways that we could look at Bimei Shifot HaShoftim, one of which I saw in some commentaries, is to say that maybe it wasn't known. I mean, if this was being written a long time after this happened, again, this has to be written from a seeming perspective, and even according to Chazal, by Shmuel, likely at the end of his life, we're talking about a very long time that's elapsed. Is this an important detail to the story? Possibly not. So even though we might say other details were filled in by Ruach HaKodesh, especially for Shmuel, who we know to be a Navi altogether, maybe he just didn't remember who was the Shofet then or didn't really care. So he said, yeah, it was sometime during the Shoftim. And I don't think that's an unreasonable read either. One particularly interesting read that I thought, that I saw, was something that I would never have thought of until I saw this. And then I said, I'm still not sure that I agree with it, but definitely something to think about, which is, what if it was obvious? What if the person writing the book thought everybody would know which Shofet this was happening during? There would be no need to write any more detail to this. Now, does anybody know offhand? And again, you should know this probably from the set of Shiurim up until now. There's really only one, maybe two options for this, but what's the one overwhelming option as to if we were to say that this is written in this fashion because there's no need to specify further, everybody knows, what approach would we have to take that we've seen in the Midrashim in the previous Shiurim? There's one identification that we talked about a little bit. So what identification might that be? Anyone? Anybody on this list sound familiar from Megillas Rus? I'm trying not to give it away too much.
Shamgar sounds familiar. I don't know. Maybe it's...
Shamgar sounds familiar. Well, we talked about him a little bit. I wrote on the table, Ivtsan, possibly Boaz. For those who are paying really close attention right at the beginning of chapter 2, when we introduced Boaz, we talked about a Chazal identify him with a Shofet named Ivtsan from Beit Lechem. If I take it as a given that Ivtsan is Boaz, which in many, many traditional circumstances, they did. In many places in the Gemara, it's an absolute given. As we saw in the Gemara that talked about Boaz being an almon, Boaz being a widower, the very simple understanding of that, and as it was taken within the Gemara, is, of course, why? Because Ivtsan is described, and we don't have the psukim on him here, as having many, many children. And we understand that he married Ruth only later, and that he had lost his wife and his children married out here and there. And I'm not going to get into the character of Ivtsan too much. But what's important to note is that this suggestion is not all that wild. If you assume that everybody made that equation of Ivtsan is Boaz and everybody knew that, well then, yeah, Bimei Shofot HaShoftim, of course. We literally tell you who the Shofet is in the story. We tell you it's Boaz. Boaz is a Shofet. And which Shofet is that? It happens to be Ivtsan. Now, Ivtsan, note, we have listed the Psukim as being the official Shofet for only 7 years. Even if we do identify Boaz as Ivtsan, this still gives us some leeway up and down in terms of when he may have served as the official Shofet. He may have served as the official Shofet when he was more advanced in age. He may have served as the official Shofet when he was much younger. We know that he was called an Ish Gibor Chayil, and we can make parallels out of that. But that's something to keep in mind, is another possibility of what Bimei Shavot HaShoftim may mean. Again, if I would write Bimei Shavot HaShoftim and later in the story I would refer to an actual Shofet, I don't think anybody would question the fact that I wrote Bimei Shavot HaShoftim to begin with. So that's another suggestion that I thought was very interesting. We talked about the Yichus at the end. Let's move on to think about some of these particular suggestions that we saw in the Medrash. So first of all, just in terms of our genealogy at the end, taking a look, towards the end of Ehud, Ehud's reign and Shamgar, you're dealing with quite a long time before David HaMelech is born. Quite a long time. Even if you're dealing with Devorah, you're still having, you know, probably close to 200 years from when this story takes place until David becomes king. Not necessarily till he's born, but till he becomes king. I don't know that we have a good indication of when, at what age he became king. I didn't go to look up the psukim on that. I'm sorry. But I don't know if it says anywhere explicitly. So ostensibly speaking, let's say it's happening sometime in the times of, you know, either the end of Ehud or within the time of Devorah and Barak and Yael, in this area over here that you can see is highlighted. So towards the middle or end of their reign, you're dealing with, let's assume, Boaz has Oved with about 140 years left to say for Shoftim. And again, you can deal with the rest of this chronology. People have different opinions on this. Some people have Shimshon being 20 years as a ruler, and that, I guess, the oppression of the Plishtim, which is stated to be for 40 years, would have been prior to that, overlapping with other judges. There are ways to minimize this. You can tweak the numbers a little bit. But in general, again, as I said, this is a rough estimate. So you're dealing with probably Oved being born about 190 years before David becomes king. That's a long time for something like that. So that's something to consider. Oved, maybe, let's say age 50, age 60, age 70, gives birth to Yishai. Yishai maybe at age 60, age 70, maybe even older. And again, we said this was, we have some evidence to assume that he may have had David at a later stage in life. So that can take care of 140. And if David becomes king at 60 years old, so maybe you can start to question that a little bit. Otherwise, again, and if you tweak the numbers and get out 20 years, it is technically possible, but it would require that these people be very old when they have their children, which, as we said, is possible. Or it would require that you are skipping generations even from this point on. That seems unlikely, because if you look back at the beginning, at the first pasuk that we quoted in source number 3, who avi Yishai avi David. There we explicitly say he was the father of Yishai, and Yishai was the father of David. Now, could you say Av is maybe a grandfather too? Not really, because doesn't really seem that that's the case here. So that would be a stretch. You'd need to assume that people were very, very old when they had their children, which we have to assume anyways. But nevertheless, something to think about. That's what Chazal say. What about the other details that we discussed up front in the first pasuk? We said, what types of indications might you have about the ruling of Shamgar, of Ehud, of Devorah, of Barak, in regards to those other two details? Do we know of any particular famines that happened during those points in time? We do not. As far as I was aware, as far as I'm aware, there aren't too many explicit famines in Sefer Shoftim. There is only one time, in fact, where it seems like people don't have food, maybe two. And we'll get to those, but they were not during those times. It is possible that there were famines. It's quite likely there were famines over the period of the judges, but we don't know this for a fact. What about the connections between Moab and Beit Lechem? Might there have been open borders during those times? Might people have been going back and forth? Might it have been something negative to be coming from Moab, like we see Ruth, oh, she's just a Moabiyah, or she came back from Moab? Any indication of that? Does anybody know, what is Ehud famous for in Sefer Shoftim? He commits a very famous assassination. Who does he assassinate? A man by the name of? I don't hear anything. Eglon. Who is Eglon? What's his day job? Anybody know?
Isn't he a fat king?
He's a fat king. Of which country?
I don't know. I'm going for Moab, since it's you're asking.
Yes, he was, Eglon was the king of Moab. I don't know if I wrote that. I hope I wrote that. Yes, includes 18 years of oppression by Eglon, brackets Moab. Ehud puts an end to that by, you know, the very disturbing story of him sneaking in and sticking his sword in his belly and all sorts of the graphic details that accompany that. But afterwards, there's a period of time in which the Jewish people actually defeat Moab and actually enslave them to some extent. That would be prime time in which roads might be open between the two countries and people might be able to travel. And it also would be a time where people would look very much down upon Moabites. There are all sorts of suggestions. I mean, you can see this stuff in Dr. Ziegler's book. You can see this in all sorts of other commentaries and people making all sorts of wild suggestions based on different sources. And maybe Elimelech was a political leader and he was going to do some sort of political mission there and all sorts of different ideas. But the point is that actually might work very well with this detail that we know from Megillas Rus about Moab. and about traveling there and about coming back and returning. This is bolstered very, very much by a medrash which we see elsewhere. If you take a look in source number 7, it's a medrash which comes up in Gemara Nazir, comes up in Sota, comes up in Sanhedrin, comes up in Horios in slight modifications. Va'amar Rabbi Yossi b'Rabbi Chanina, Rus bas beno shel Eglon melech Moav haisa. Rus was either the daughter or the granddaughter. This Gemara has granddaughter, but others have daughter of Eglon, king of Moab. And in fact, Dat Mikra in particular says that everybody agrees with this. This is some sort of tradition that we had, that Rus was actually related to Eglon in some way. Again, one generation down, two generations down. And that's why everybody over here in this Medrash, in Rus Rabbah, is dating it approximately at that time, because this was a tradition that people had. They don't say this explicitly, but it's clear from what they write there that everybody had this tradition. Everybody's trying to say it was either slightly after Eglon or it was a little bit longer after Eglon, but either way, you're dealing with that as a tradition. In general, it's always important for us to question, and I will leave this as a question. When Chazal say something, is it because they knew the matter by tradition, that there was a long-standing tradition that this was the case? Or do we say they're just guessing or learning things out based on details in the Pesukim the same way that we are? Many people would argue in a case like this where you seem to have so many different opinions. One opinion says Ivsan is Boaz, and that's when it's taking place. Another opinion seems to say it's happening during Barak and Devorah. Another opinion seems to say it's happening during Edun Shamgar. So people would say maybe that's just because they are deriving things from the Pesukim the same way that we might. However, this is just to show there are those who actually interpret this as there is one dominant tradition, and that would be the tradition of Rus being some descendant of Eglon Melech Moav, and therefore having it dated between those times for the story would be something of interest. In particular, in terms of dealing with these traditions, one very interesting source that people like to look at, especially academics, is Josephus. Josephus seems to be aware of a number of rabbinic traditions. Many of them are preserved by Chazal and Josephus, and sometimes you have obviously many things that are preserved in Chazal, not Josephus, but sometimes you have things that are in Josephus that we know were the views of Chazal, and we may not have had them in so many explicit sources. Josephus, interestingly, says this happens post-Shimshon. So basically in his chronology he says after the death of Samson, Eli the high priest was governor of the Israelites. Under him was when the country was afflicted by a famine, and then he goes on to tell the story of Rus. What that means is you're dealing with basically, let's assume this happens immediately upon Eli becoming the leader of the Jewish people, and again you're dealing with about 50-60 years, maybe, again depending on how much you can stretch the chronology, 50-60 years till David becomes king. So Ovid is born, Ovid has Yishai at age 20, Yishai has David at age 20, and David becomes a king when he's fairly young. That's the way that this is going to work. People reject this because they say that's just too soon. Although, again, in those times, it could be very likely that people were having their children at age 20. But nevertheless, people reject it. If you see even in the notes there from the English translation of it, that's I think from the 1700s, and they write, nay, long before him. What do you think? What are you, crazy? You think it was during Eli? The motivation for Josephus to say this is very interesting. This has gotten a lot of discussion because Josephus seems to make mention somewhere of there being only 22 books in Tanakh. And that's something that raises a lot of eyebrows because we know, of course, there are 24 books in Tanakh, and it's, you know, we're not sure exactly what Josephus is saying. So people suggest that he actually had Rus as sort of attached to Sefer Shoftim, and Echa was attached to Yirmiyah. Either way, we're not here to talk about that so much, but there does seem to be evidence that very early on, I'm not talking about canonically that we didn't have Tanakh, we did have Torah, Neviim, and Ksuvim, but that Rus was placed immediately after Shoftim. If that was the case, it would be only natural for people to assume that it happened at the end of Sefer Shoftim in between Shimshon, which is, we assume to be chronologically the last shofet of Sefer Shoftim, and Eli, who opens Sefer Shmuel, which follows it. And people talk about that. People talk about other ideas that might motivate Josephus here. That might be one. I mean, some other ideas that we can throw in there is the fact that the chronology is pretty close to David. It sounds like we're really close. Ovid is Avi Yishai, Avi David. Like, that's really, You know, so if it's finishing, it does seem to be close in some ways to David becoming king. But also, if you look elsewhere in Chazal, as we've mentioned many times, not many times, but a couple of times at least, did I bring this here? Yes, in source number 9. Shmuel Kasav Sifro Vishoftim Virus. Shmuel Hanavi was actually the one who wrote his Sefer and Shoftim and Rus. Again, depending on how much we want to make it closer to Shmuel's time, that may be as to why he would be the best person to write this, or whatever the reason may be. It could be that some people would emphasize that. However, that's unlikely, because if he also wrote the entire Sefer Shoftim, then there's no reason to date at the end of Sefer Shoftim just because Shmuel wrote it. But, you know, these are types of things that people may consider. Okay. Let's move on. A couple of other ideas that we see in...
Can you bring up the source sheet? Like, I can't see number 9. Could you bring it up there?
9? So, yeah, it's over here. Bava Basra 14b, that Shmuel wrote his own book. And again, that's where you get the idea. This may have been the original order that these books were sort of learned in Tanakh. So something to think about. A couple of non-Jewish sources that place Rus during other judges. Some people place it in the time of Yiftach. And this comes at the end of a paragraph where he lists about 10 views in source number 10, such as the uncertainty about the time referred to. Yiftach, again, if you look back up, is someone that's towards the end, just right before Ivtzan. And that may give you an actually pretty good chronology approach, but that seems to be one of the reasons for doing so. The other reason is because it takes into account, and I'm going back up here, Vayira of Baretz. If you look, and here's what I bring, not for Yiftach, that was for Gidom, my mistake. I'm jumping back between 10 and 8 and confusing them. Yiftach, doesn't really seem to be much indication as to why we would say that happened during that time. Number 8, on the other hand, some scholars date Ruth as a contemporary of Gideon. Some do this because of Judges 6:3-4, which refers to a lack of food during Gideon's judgeship. And therefore, we have the detail. The only real time where it talks about a Sefer Shoftim of a lack of food is during Gideon. So we say, Vayira of Ba'aretz, that must be at that same time. Again, that's a sort of very simple way to look at it, but maybe a way of identifying what's happening. He does not like this approach because he says Ra'av has to mean a famine. Something of natural causes, so that shortage, he says, not due to famine, but to the yearly invasions of the Midianites. Moreover, it seems like there would have been several famines in Israel during the approximately 300-year period of the Judges, and other people disagree, you know, this would place within Devorah, this would place within this, this would place within that. At the end of the day, I think that the goal here is not to find a particularly good answer, but I think that the goal is to try to figure out what types of building blocks these people used when they were trying to identify a particular time that the story took place. And I think that we've done a pretty good job of that. We've done that by pointing out the main issues within the Megillah that we would look at. And we've done that by looking at the local approaches and saying what might motivate that approach. The approach might be motivated by the placement of the book and where it's learned. I'm going to get to your question in a moment. It might be motivated by something within the text. It might be motivated by something that we see repeated. It might be motivated by tradition. But all in all, we do see that all of these factors do motivate something like this. Yes?
I'm embarrassed to ask this question, but I'm asking it anyway because I know that you'll know the answer. It seems like all of the judges were sequential, but I just noticed with Gideon, like Gideon did not live anywhere near Beit Lechem, so could it not have been one judge was up there and one judge was down there? And
that is an excellent question. When I went looking for this chart and not have to make it myself, I searched both in English and in Hebrew, and I think you're going to have a lot. Especially of contemporary writers, but even, for those who've learned Shoftim better, they will know this, but even potentially traditional scholars who may say that, yes, this may have been in one section of the land and this may have been in one section, especially since the Shoftim are identified as being from particular places. And it is quite likely, and I think this is an important detail as well, and the truth is I had this on my list of stuff to mention, that yes, if we understand that the Shoftim were not sequential, one after the other, all over the entire Bnei Yisrael, but that there may have been two people going on in different places at the same time, and this place may have been attacked by the Plishtim simultaneously to the time that this place was victorious over Ammon, yes, you can definitely work with that. And if you look, you will see a number of different sort of charts, tables, timelines that actually do have different Shoftim ruling simultaneously in different areas. And I don't know, again, enough about Sefer Shoftim to say whether that's right or wrong, but certainly that is something that has a lot of merit and should be considered here, which is exactly goes back to our point that we made about Vahibi Me Shifot HaShoftim. That's where I was going to put it in the discussion, that you may have had multiple Shoftim at one time, and it wouldn't be fair to identify this one over this one. Again, unless, you know, maybe you would say the one that was in that area or that ruled over that area, but if you had someone else in a different area, and they were traveling from Beit Lechem to Moab, which can be, as we mentioned, a whole number of different routes, maybe they would pass through another Shofates sort of reigned at that time. So yes, I think that's an excellent point, and that should certainly be taken into account. Many, though, make the argument that this is left intentionally vague, as we mentioned at the beginning. You know, some state is stronger than others. The Book of Ruth's deliberately vague time frame indicates that any attempt to date the book definitively is at odds with the objective of the book itself, which presents Ruth as the solution to the entire era. I mean, that's obviously built off of something that she's developed there. And she developed some very nice ideas as to how Ruth interacts with the entire Sefer Shoftim. And the end of Sefer Shoftim, spends a lot of time developing that. But I don't know that everybody would agree with that. But nevertheless, she believes that all of these suggestions are not suggestions as to when the book took place, but actually suggestions as to how to contrast it properly, which is another, you know, question that we'd have to go into. But that's her approach, and I thought that was definitely something worth bringing, again, with her expertise on the subject. But all in all, we're able to, I think the activity is more important than the result in this case, where it's true. We aren't given an exact time frame in Megillas Rus. Might that be on purpose? It very well might be. Might it be for any of the other reasons that we mentioned? It very well might be as well. But the ability to take all of these different details and say, we figured out why someone might think that, and to realize that by writing Bimei Shifot HaShoftim, Shmuel HaNavi is essentially allowing for us to do this, I think is something very, very important we should take out of the Sefer. And this, I think, could serve as one method of introduction to the Sefer by dealing with this part of the Sefer, and I hope that you've enjoyed this again exercise as well as the rest of the shiurim. And thank you to those of you who came out tonight.
Thank you.
Thanks again. Bye.
Good night, everybody.
Night.